Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscone. Researchers are taking a new approach in their battle against Alzheimer's disease. There's been limited success in treating the disease or even slowing its progress, but a change in FDA policy combined with a large federal grant will now allow researchers to focus more on prevention. This hour, we look at where we stand in the fight against this devastating disease. We'll also talk about the challenges of living with Alzheimer's and caring for someone with the disease. To help us do that, we have two guests. Jason Karlowish is Professor of Medicine, Medical Ethics, and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine, where he directs care for patients at the Penn Memory Center and directs the Neurodegenerative Disease Ethics and Policy Program. Jason, welcome. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Tracy.
And also with us is Laura Gitlin. Laura is professor in the Department of Community Public Health in the School of Nursing and director of the Center for Innovative Care in Aging at Johns Hopkins University. Laura, welcome.
Thank you, Tracy. It's an honor to be here.
Well, Jason, I'd like to start with you. How would you characterize the progress that we've made in Alzheimer's research thus far?
It's been mixed. We've made tremendous progress in understanding the pathology, the pathophysiology, and the stages of the disease. But where we haven't had the same kind of progress is translating that research into better ways to treat patients. And in some sense, our treatments are really no farther, our pharmacologic treatments, I should say, are no farther along than they were at the end of the 20th century.
So has the focus mostly been on people who are beginning to show signs or maybe in advanced stages of Alzheimer's as opposed to looking at people earlier on?
Correct. So, you know, when we talk about Alzheimer's disease up through the 20th century and into the beginning of this century, it's largely when we say Alzheimer's disease, we mean people who are demented, meaning they have impairments in their memory and other cognitive abilities that lead them to be disabled. They have troubles managing their money, driving, etc. We're beginning to think about the disease as not simply at a stage when someone's disabled, but at a stage where you can identify it before they're disabled. Even we're beginning to think we can start to identify the disease before someone has even any signs or symptoms. We're not there yet, but we're beginning to make this shift courtesy of the progress of about a half century's worth of research, understanding the pathology and the pathophysiology of the disease.
I want to talk, that brings up a couple of things. One, the FDA is loosening some of its rules around some of these tests. How does that impact what researchers are trying to do?
Well, it impacts researchers a lot. Well, when we say FDA is loosening, what they're doing is they're acknowledging a reality, which is if I were going to intervene in Alzheimer's disease defined as not being demented but maybe having merely a mild memory problem or even no memory problem, well, how would I show that I benefited that patient? Well, at best what I might be able to show is that the change in their cognition over time was slowed, that they were less likely to lose cognitive ability. They're not impaired functionally because they're normal. So FDA had to kind of acknowledge the fact that if we go into this, quote, preclinical space is the phrase, and I think it's a difficult phrase, but it's what we're using. If we go into that space, we have to have new ways of thinking about what benefit would mean. Under the dementia model, the benefit meant the person's less disabled. They have functional improvement. They have cognitive improvement that are noticeable, for example. But in the space where people are at most mildly impaired, if not at all, you have to have a new way of thinking about benefit, which leads to enormous challenges both clinically but on a policymaking setting of how would you just say that that amount of benefit was, quote, worth the cost for chronic treatment. And yet, of course, there's a great appeal to going into that space because wouldn't you want to be treated before you were disabled?
Well, and that raises a question, though, about early diagnosis, about how people would be identified for
Correct.
This type of study, because there is that question of, do you even want to know that information far out in advance, and how do you sort of grapple with that? So how does that play into all of this?
Well, I think there's a logical space that we can occupy that's scientifically rigorous, logical, and ethical, and that's to say, at this point in 2013 America, I think it's reasonable for someone who wants to be in research to discover better ways to diagnose and treat the disease before you're impaired, I think it's reasonable for those kinds of individuals to learn if they have a genetic or biomarker marker that would potentially predict they're at higher risk of developing impairment and therefore are eligible for a clinical trial to test a drug to affect that risk. That space, I think, is a ethically sound space to be in. I don't see any logic at this point for engaging that kind of testing just to kind of, quote, want to know, because in part we're not sure what we know when we start testing people who are essentially asymptomatic using these biomarkers. Mm-hmm. So they're great eligibility criteria for clinical trials, and in fact the federal government has invested many millions of dollars in those trials. They're going to start soon. That's where we should be.
Yeah. What was the number? Something like 33 million roughly that we're looking at?
We're over 100 now, and because the federal government recently invested about $30 million into a clinical trial to enroll people who are at high genetic risk. They've invested also another $60 million in a clinical trial that will enroll people between the ages of 65 and 85 who are cognitively normal but have a PET amyloid imaging scan that shows elevated amyloid in their brain. So that's another prevention trial model. That study will start very soon. It'll take 3 years to follow the subjects. It'll require about 1,000 subjects. But this is this new paradigm, if you will, of prevention driven by biomarker labels.
Yeah. What is amyloid?
Amyloid is one of the two pathologic hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease dementia. So if I find a patient with Alzheimer's disease dementia and I biopsy or autopsy their brain, in their neocortex I'll find dense concentrations of tau tangles and amyloid plaques. And we've been very successful in identifying amyloid not just post-mortem, but we can now visualize it in vivo, in life, using a PET scan.
Is there a way to tell early on, I mean well before the onset of symptoms, that someone is at risk for Alzheimer's?
Well, there is right now, sure. With, for example, APOE genotyping and other lifestyle profiles, you can calculate someone's risk of developing dementia. You can do that now, and anyone can go to 23andMe or any other commercial site that sells genotyping and buy that gene result if they wish it. Mm. But I think what you're hinting at is, could we do tests, say, of amyloid using PET scans and then give someone a foretelling of their future? The answer to that simply is no, not yet, not right now. Why? We just don't simply have enough good data over enough time and enough people to give risk estimates that I think would be meaningful for the general population. Moreover, as Medicare is struggling with right now, the logic of putting that test out there is not supported by, I think, enough value in individuals who are cognitively normal. Although I think there's great value in a very subset of people who are cognitively impaired, who are young, who may have Alzheimer's disease or frontal temporal dementia.
What's the typical, if there is a typical, age at which you might see the onset of Alzheimer's symptoms?
The symptoms of the disease, symptoms, complaints, functional impairments really begin to take off as people enter into their 70s. You start to see them occur in the beyond 65, but once people get to 70, 75, that's when we start to see incidence rates of about 5% per year, which is pretty high incidence rate for any disease.
Mm-hmm. Laura Gitlin, no doubt you have seen that, and perhaps even earlier, because there are those people who are diagnosed much younger than that with Alzheimer's, correct?
Yes, and many times people who are diagnosed very early on have other forms of dementia, such as frontotemporal dementia. But what happens is that dementia is really a disease of the family. So oftentimes family members, a spouse, a husband, a daughter, recognize certain changes that are occurring, and they don't know exactly what they are, and they go through a process of, I would just call it, hypothesis testing. Well, Dad was just really tired. He didn't have a good day, so he got lost when he went to get his hair cut, until something triggers that diagnosis. So sometimes families really do see, or the person themselves recognize, that they are not functioning at the level that they're used to. But they're not quite sure what that is. So some of these symptoms, as Jason indicated, do occur very early on, which is why also the whole scientific community is looking at preclinical symptoms. And I think in a way families and people themselves can have a role in identifying preclinical symptoms at some point, in addition to, of course, the focus on biomarkers, because people are very sensitive to the kinds of changes that are occurring to themselves.
Well, that brings up an interesting question, Jason, for researchers. If someone comes in and says, look, something just doesn't seem right, but they seem okay you know, in every other respect, but it's just something to them seems different that's not discernible on the outside. So can it be difficult to make a diagnosis or to get to the point where you're saying, okay, there really is something going on, even though it's very, very subtle right now?
Well, sure. I mean, your question answers it, which is the margins of any degenerative disease at the margins of mildness are always very difficult to diagnose. I think right now, clinically, where the field's at is we're very good at labeling people to determine whether they're demented or not. And I think in the hands of a competent physician trained in taking care of older adults with cognitive problems, we're good at finding people who have what we call mild cognitive impairment. That's about the limits of our expertise right now in clinical practice. Someday, maybe we'll be able to make profiles of individuals who have at most mild complaints of cognition with no measurable cognitive problems and label them as saying, you know, you've got Alzheimer's disease as your underlying pathology. We're not there yet, both in terms of doing that labeling, but also linking it to an essential other piece in that puzzle, which is an intervention. And it's not just because we need the intervention to give people some benefit. We need the intervention to help validate that that cluster of symptoms foretells a future decline. And I think you just have to look below the neck at other diseases of aging, like hypertension, cardiovascular disease, and osteoporosis, to see that that link in the asymptomatic individual between a test and a drug is essential, not just to give benefit that we have to then debate, is it worth it, but also to validate whether that construct is a real construct that fits this new notion of disease that doesn't rely on signs and symptoms, which is where the Alzheimer's field would like to go. But to your listeners, we're not ready there now. Please don't call up the memory center and say, I want that test that might tell me what my future is. Yeah. We don't have that test. 5 years from now, we may, but right now, not right now.
The study that is about to take place, yeah. How long might it take to get some real data that yeah. would be helpful for researchers?
So the anti-amyloid and asymptomatic Alzheimer's study, known as the A4 study, will start enrolling probably in January of 2014, and we'll be a site at the University of Pennsylvania for that, along with 40 other sites throughout the nation. We'll enroll across the nation 1,000 people. 500 people will be randomly assigned to an anti-amyloid drug. 500 people will be randomly assigned to a placebo. They'll receive an infusion every 4 weeks of this anti-amyloid drug. To be in that study, you have to have a PET scan that shows you have elevated amyloid, and we will tell you that result. And we've taken a lot – I've been leading an effort to design a process to tell people that so that it minimizes the harms of learning that information. That study will require each subject to be followed for 3 years. My hunch there, 2014, add 3 years, 2017, one more year for the lag. At the earliest, maybe we'll read that study out in about 2017. So it's possible in 2017 that we'll have transformed what we think about when we think about a 65 to 80-year-old who's amyloid imaging positive into a condition, maybe we would start to call it amyloidosis of the brain, that therefore has this intervention to reduce cognitive decline. That's a possibility that we may see before 2017.
We are talking about Alzheimer's, an update on what has been happening in the research end of things, but also we want to talk about just what are the challenges that patients and caregivers face every day as it relates to Alzheimer's. We'll be back with much more and your calls as well when Radio Times comes back.
AM1112 Productions, Philadelphia's all comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, Bunny Bunny, Gilda Radner, a sort of romantic comedy. An imaginary biography of comedy legend Gilda Radner, Bunny Bunny is a time capsule of Gilda's life and career. From her big break on Saturday Night Live, Bunny Bunny presents Gilda Radner in all her glory, sarcastic, charming, and always funny. Tickets and information at 1812productions.org.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, a relatively new diagnosis, the Truman Show delusion. People who believe their entire lives are reality shows. We'll speak to the doctor who coined the phrase and a young man who lived it. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, supports WHYY and is accepting clients at their Center for Psychotherapy in Bala Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, Beck Institute has served the region since 1994 by providing treatment for psychological challenges, including depression, anxiety, and stress. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moss-Cohen, and we are talking about Alzheimer's disease, what has been happening as far as research is concerned, but also what are the challenges and what do patients and caregivers need to know and to do as they battle this disease. We are talking with a couple of guests. Jason Karlowish is here. He is professor of medicine, medical ethics, and health policy at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. Laura Gitlin is with us as well. She is professor in the Department of Community Public Health in the School of Nursing and director of the Center for Innovative Care in Aging at Johns Hopkins University. That is a mouthful, for sure. We welcome your calls to our conversation. Again, we're talking about Alzheimer's, an update on the research piece of it, but also perhaps you are caring for someone with Alzheimer's disease. You've got a loved one who has Alzheimer's disease. You're just concerned about this issue. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 888-477-9499. Jason, when we left off, we were talking about the study that is coming up, and Penn is going to be one of the sites for that study. What happens in terms of the long-term follow-up? I mean, you're looking at a preventative kind of thing, right? You want to catch people very early, but what about the importance of sort of following this out for a number of years and seeing what kind of data you get over the long term?
It's a huge issue you've raised, Tracy, which is we develop drugs as quickly as possible for a number of reasons. One of which, for example, is the life of the patent of a drug is just that, and it will end. So there's an urge to get the drug studied and out as quick as possible. I can understand that. There's also a desire to get an effective treatment out. But then these treatments are prescribed for years beyond what they were tested in the clinical trials. And the paradigm that we kind of lived with in the 20th century clearly shows the problems with that paradigm, because once the drugs are out there and used, we accumulate a host of evidence around their risks and side effects that we couldn't get during the clinical trial. And frankly, also the drugs begin to be used wider than they were sort of studied within the clinical trial. I think what we need to do is set up a system that better respects the need to get drugs out that are effective, but then follow them in a more scientifically rigorous way over the many years that they're used to gather real data about their safety and efficacy so that we're giving the right drug to the right patient and for the right amount of time. And that model is not yet fully set up in the United States, and it's one that needs to be established so that beyond the phase 3 development of a drug, we can continue to gather good evidence. I think the rise of the electronic medical record is one big step towards getting that kind of data to inform clinicians and policymakers. Yeah.
And of course, there is always that concern that a drug may work for someone early on, or perhaps the person doesn't really have a great need for it, but they're taking it, and over time, there are some other side effects that have nothing to do with the dementia issue that then have to be addressed, but you don't know that for a long time.
That's correct. Yeah. That's correct. I mean, the history, the future history of Alzheimer's disease has in some sense been already written in the histories of diseases like cardiovascular disease, osteoporosis, and diabetes. And I think it's a wise sort of Alzheimer's policymaker and clinician will look to that past to see what our future could be and take some of those lessons and models to say, well, how could we do it better and differently? Not that we did it wrong in the past, but we certainly learned as we wandered into the field of chronic disease diagnosis and treatment what that new model of number-driven diagnostics and therapeutics for life can be.
Mm-hmm. Laura Gitlin, I want to talk about the behavioral changes. I mean, when someone is diagnosed, or perhaps even before they're diagnosed, is there a typical process that people go through? Is it highly individualized? In general, what does it begin to look like?
It's a great question. We often think that dementia and Alzheimer's is just a disease of memory loss, but it is. It affects other aspects of a person's cognition, and behavioral symptoms are a hallmark of the disease. And basically are universal. They occur across all different types of dementia and across the trajectory of the disease. And these behaviors are very, very varied, and they can be very challenging to families and formal caregivers, as well as to the person themselves. And some recent research has shown that without treating these behaviors and behavioral disturbances, that they actually can accelerate the progression of the disease. So we really must take very seriously the assessment, the prevention, and assessment and treatment of behavioral symptoms. And when I say behavioral symptoms, sometimes, you know, it's called behavioral and psychological symptoms or neuropsychiatric symptoms, and they refer to a whole cluster of behaviors that are non-cognitive in general. And they can range from repetitive vocalizations, shadowing, wandering, elopement attempts, to rejection of care, to hallucinations, delusions, and so forth. So there's a whole range of behaviors that are associated with the disease.
I want to go to the phones to Langhorn, PA, and we'll welcome Henry to our conversation. Hi, Henry. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. My question is this. Has to do with genetic or hereditary factors. My wife has been diagnosed with frontal temporal degeneration by the University of Penn. Her father had very similar symptoms when he passed back in 2001. And her grandmother, who I never met, she died apparently when she was 65. She was also in that age group that was experiencing some sort of dementia. And, of course, at that time they called it senility or hardening of the arteries. So I was just wondering about the hereditary factor.
Well, thank you, Henry. Genetics. Jason, what do you say?
In frontotemporal dementia, which is an uncommon form of neurodegenerative dementia, it typically occurs in individuals who are under the age of 65, and actually the incidence starts to decline after the age of 65. We know less about that disease than we do about Alzheimer's disease, though in the last several years we've made great progress in understanding the phenotypes of the disease, and there are many different sort of types of frontal temporal dementia, and also the genetics of the disease. And I think with respect to the caller's question, you know, it's a perfect question to ask the geneticist at the Frontal Temporal Dementia Center, who is there, because we're keen to understand the genetics of that disease. And we've made great progress in identifying some of the genes that we think are associated with developing frontal temporal dementia.
When it comes to Alzheimer's, how important is family history there?
So now flip it to Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease is more and more becoming a term that captures many things within it. It's becoming a bit of an unstable term. The Alzheimer's disease that Auguste Dee had in 1907 that Dr. Aloys Alzheimer's described, she was 50 years old at her diagnosis, and she carried a dominant gene that is, if you have it, you're going to get the disease. Mm-hmm. It's an uncommon form of the disease. It describes maybe 200,000 people in the United States. In contrast, the more common form of the disease, which occurs after about the ages of 65, 70 years in terms of its incidence, there our understanding of the genetics is a little less complete, and I think in part because there is no one gene. Having said that, we have identified one gene called the apolipoprotein E gene, where among its three forms of the gene, there are certain combinations which relentless data gathered over many years shows it increases your risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. And combination that is most at risk is those people who are APOE44. They have the highest risk. But even there, you can be an E44 homozygote, as we would call it, and never develop Alzheimer's disease.
You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. We are talking about Alzheimer's disease, and we want to go to the phones again to Mount Airy and Freda. Hi, Freda. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. So my father died of Alzheimer's disease. He was diagnosed at about, probably in his late 60s, had a very, very long, protracted course. Brilliant man, and unfortunately he was aware when he was diagnosed because he was a physician of what was going on. It was really heart-wrenching. He died at age 80. And so obviously I'm very, you know, some people would say paranoid about developing the disease myself. How much validity is there borne out by research in the popular view that if you do kind of brain flexing exercises, mental, you know, sort of mental gymnastics, memory exercises, how much is borne out by research that that really may help prevent symptom onset?
Okay, thank you for your call.
Well, Freda, I'm sorry to hear about your father. I know it's very difficult. The bottom line is there's a huge market in selling, quote, brain games to people. It's into the millions, if not even approaching probably $1 billion. For that amount of money that people are spending, I think the quality of the data that shows which game for how long and which people you should do is thin at best. Having said that, there is good data from a variety of studies that an engaged mind is a healthy mind. And by engaged mind, I mean socially active, cognitively active. Now, how do you keep your – you may decide, therefore, one way I'm going to engage my mind cognitively is to do games. But the leap between someone who's in a book club and helps run the volunteer service at Mount Airy and you know, exercises three times a week versus the game you should go out and buy and play for 30 minutes a day, that we don't have that connection. So, again – maintain a socially and cognitively and engaged life, the data suggests you're less likely over time to develop cognitive impairment than someone who, quote, doesn't do those things.
Hmm. Laura, what about some of those other options? Jason just mentioned exercise, for instance.
Yes, I was going to add to what Jason said, is that the evidence is still developing in this area. But it's clear that engaging in all different kinds of activities and being open to novelty and trying new things, as well as physical exercise, is promising. It is somewhat protective. It doesn't mean, just as Jason said, that if you do different kinds of crossword puzzles every single night, you're not going to get, you know, the disease. And by the way, age is one of the still the biggest risk factors of the disease. So we've talked about it in terms of a genetic disposition, but age remains one of the biggest risk factors.
Let's go back to the phones to Chalfont and Sue. Welcome, Sue, to Radio Times.
Thank you. My grandmother had Alzheimer's for many, many years, and it eventually turned out that she had to be tube-fed because she forgot how to eat. And my question is, are there legal / medical directives that can be used these days so that that doesn't occur if you don't want it to?
That's a good question, Sue. Thank you.
Yeah, so that's a very good question, and this is such a difficult area, and we're just beginning to have very honest discussions about end of life, and there's nothing easy about it, and these decisions also have ethical, medical, and personal cultural meanings. There is a document that you can retrieve online called Five Wishes, which helps families go through five very simple questions about what kind of care they would like to receive at different points as they age. And that document can serve as a legal advance directive, if you will, in, I think, over 43 states right now, and it's being used by 13 million people. And that gets back to an earlier point, that that's one of the reasons why it's very helpful to have a diagnosis early on so you can begin to have these kinds of discussions and use a document like Five Wishes or you know, something similar.
The number to call is 888-477-9499 if you'd like to join our conversation about Alzheimer's disease, about the latest research, as well as the challenges for patients and for their caregivers. Laura, I'm thinking about the person who is diagnosed but still has high cognitive function. How do you advise someone in that position? What do you say to them at that point? Because that's an incredibly heavy load for someone to have to bear.
Yes, it is. And I think at this point we have not mastered how to deliver that diagnosis. So to this date, families are often told that they have some kind of dementia, and it's up to them to figure out what to do. They're often not even informed that there's an Alzheimer's Association that has excellent resources and help for them. We could do a much better job in terms of dementia care. We don't have in our country yet comprehensive dementia care that would provide people the kinds of supports that they will need. This is a disease that occurs over a long period of time, and the needs of the individual and the family do change as the disease progresses. So having a model of care that allows support for both the individual and the family over time is really something we need to strive for.
I think Laura's brought up a very important point among several important points throughout. I just want to hammer one home. If you're diagnosed with diabetes, you get access to a nutritionist to help understand what's the disease and how to live with it. If you're diagnosed with cardiovascular disease, particularly if you've had a heart attack, you get access to an exercise therapist, a cardiovascular rehab, okay? I do not understand why we don't have a healthcare system set up that if you're diagnosed with a failing brain, you can't get access to resources to help learn how to live with a failing brain. It just boggles my mind more and more.
Why is that, Jason? Why are we lacking in this particular area?
You know, we have a healthcare system which until recently was fragmented and driven by largely a for-profit model. So if there's not money to be made in it, there's not money to be made in it. And, you know, we have to recalibrate our system around value. And there's value to be had in telling people whose brains are failing how they're going to live with that problem and how the family's going to live with it. Instead, people are left to figure it out on their own. Yeah. And that's just unacceptable.
Yeah, it is. It's really unacceptable. And other countries are experimenting with assigning, for example, a care coordinator to a person and their family immediately upon diagnosis, and that they can get to meet with that person over time through phone and in-person visits where their needs are continually assessed and reassessed and then supports put into place. I think what's important to understand is that in this particular area, in terms of how we should be caring for people, we do know what to do. We have the evidence. We have excellent evidence in terms of what and how to support an individual and families. We, of course, always need more research and how to refine this, but we do know we have proven approaches that can help families across the trajectory of this disease.
I wonder about some people that I have, you know, just seen either in the public or people that I have been reading about. I was looking at an article recently about a physician who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. He is blogging mm-hmm. about his experience. I think it's called Until the Lights Go Out is the name of his blog. And he talks about some of the very difficult conversations he's had with his wife, with his family, as this goes on. He's certainly, you know, doing all of the things he can do in the meantime. I think about someone like Glenn Campbell, who was not so long ago on a tour, even
right.
with Alzheimer's. And I just think it's interesting to see people not only, you know, acknowledging their situation, but then, you know, continuing with their lives and sharing their experiences with other people.
Yeah, those are great examples of how people themselves who have been diagnosed with dementia and in the early stages have really taken the lead here in saying, listen, don't just write me off. I can be involved and active. I have contributions to make. And that's not something that, I mean, that's really very recent that the voices of people themselves with dementia have been heard, and that we've been now moving forward with looking at different ways of involving people with the disease throughout the trajectory of the disease.
Which I think is really important, because short of a efficient, effective, cheap cure, we're going to have to learn how to live with this disease. And part of that means living with the people who have it and treating them as persons.
We're talking about Alzheimer's disease, about the latest research, as well as the challenges for patients and caregivers. We welcome your calls at 888-477-9499. Radio Times will be back right after this.
The University of Delaware MBA supports WHYY. The UD MBA offers personal attention and career guidance, with smaller class sizes to foster bigger thinking, the flexibility to earn an MBA part-time, full-time, or online, and other new options to help make an MBA accessible. Drop-in information sessions will be held on Tuesdays, October 1st, 8th, 15th, and 22nd. UDMBA.com. The University of Delaware MBA. It is all about you.
For weeks, you rode for us.
A new world opens. Faces, sounds, at the speed of bike.
You wrote for us.
The world spins around. Bike wheels spin around the world. We are better for it.
And now our celebration of bicycle culture winds up with an announcement of winners. Haikus become bikus. And all the news next time on The Takeaway.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children age 12 to 25 to help them take control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about Alzheimer's disease. We're talking about what's happening as far as research is concerned and something of a shift going on toward looking at prevention. We're also talking about the challenges for people who are diagnosed with Alzheimer's, the behavioral changes that take place, and what all of this means for the people who love and care for them every day. Our guests are Laura Gitlin. She is professor in the Department of Community Public Health in the School of Nursing and director of the Center for Innovative Care in Aging at Johns Hopkins University. Jason Karlowicz is professor of medicine, medical ethics, and health policy at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. We welcome your calls as well at 888-477-9499. And Jason, one of our callers brought up the question of a vaccine for Alzheimer's. Is that something that's in the works that people are talking seriously about at this point?
It's a phrase that got picked up because the approach of some of the anti-amyloid therapies that have been tested harnesses the logic and the model of a vaccination approach, namely stirring up the immune system to go after amyloid. But the model that I think we're used to of vaccines, you get your shot once, twice, a booster here or there, is not how current is how these drugs are tested and how we think they'll work. But the rhetoric behind, or the logic behind, excuse me, the vaccine is many of the approaches to amyloid treatment rely on harnessing the immune system to clean up amyloid, if you will, to use another metaphor.
We'll go back to the phones to Mount Airy and Levi. Welcome, Levi, to Radio Times.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
My question actually was, I read a recent study that talks about the link between cyanobacteria exposure and how it affected protein misfolding and the effect it had on neurodegenerative diseases. So specifically, my question was how much research talked about the link between environmental factors and versus epigenetic factors, and what you thought about the link between the two.
Jason?
Well, Levi, that's an ambitious question. I think when you used a phrase there, which is one of the new terms of art and science in neurodegenerative diseases, namely protein misfolding. You know, more and more we're understanding these diseases as problems that of proteins no longer having the shape that they need to have to function correctly. And so, therefore, the idea of sort of a protein, if you will, being misfolded. Why proteins are misfolded? As Levi points out, we're understanding that there are a variety of both genetic, molecular, and potentially, as well, environmental causes for why proteins misfold. I think the challenge in terms of drug discovery and treatment is which of those potential pathways that we're uncovering are, if you will, actionable or manipulable so that the protein, if you will, doesn't misfold or unfolds, if you will, back into the shape that has it function and work as it should in the neuron.
We go back to the phones, and we'll go to Westchester and Joy. Welcome to Radio Times, Joy.
Hi, thank you. My question has to do with Lewy bodies dementia. My mom died last year at age 80 after suffering from that, and it seems that, you know, there's a lot of attention and research and money that goes to Alzheimer's more so than Lewy bodies dementia, and I wondered if you could address if the research that's being done on Alzheimer's will be of benefit to understanding Lewy body's dementia, or if you know about much research that's being done on Lewy bodies.
Well, Joe, I'm sorry to hear about your mother. You've got two points there, one about the Lewy body dementia, and two, kind of the policy issues that surround Lewy body dementia and other causes of neurodegeneration other than Alzheimer's disease. I think the field's arrived at a recognition that when we talk about Alzheimer's disease, we're recognizing that within a brain of even patients that are labeled with Alzheimer's disease dementia are not just the plaque and tangle pathology I talked about earlier with Tracy, but also other pathologies. And indeed, most of the sort of later onset cases contain a mixed pathology, including, for example, Lewy body pathology. Some patients have enough Lewy body pathology that that's the disease they have phenotypically, or if you will, described by the doctor when they examine them. I think the field's recognizing that these labels are sort of constrain us a bit, and funding is moving towards identifying the markers of what causes a brain to fail as opposed to the label, and only there can you study that particular pathology. And at Penn, my colleagues, Dr. Trojanowski and Dr. Lee, have made great progress working with colleagues throughout the nation, identifying these various markers of neurodegeneration, one of which is synuclein, which is one of the markers of Lewy body disease. So the answer from a policy perspective is money is flowing to identify these biomarkers. And then the next step, of course, is which ones are useful diagnostically and which ones can you intervene in experimentally to change the course of neurodegeneration.
Back to the phones, we go to Jenkintown and Betsy. Welcome to Radio Times, Betsy.
Ah, good morning. I wanted to thank the University of Pennsylvania. My husband and I were in a clinical study at Penn and were just treated with so much respect and kindness. We also, so this is really a comment more than a question, but I feel that my husband and I have, and I especially, wanted to be very proactive as we look at the disease. It's the idea of the glass half full. So though we are sorry this has happened to us, we feel that we have an opportunity to educate other people, and I'm learning as I go. My husband was confused by where to put the recycling, and when I would say paper, it was not coming through, so we've labeled the trash cans 1, 2, and 3. There are many good ways of looking at the disease also. It's helped me grow as a human being, and my husband tells me every day that he loves me, and I don't know how many wives hear that. So this is another special time in our life where we're just working at this together, and I've only the finest things to say about Penn and all the compassion they showed to us.
Well, Betsy, thank you. What a great perspective you have. Laura, what do you say?
Thank you, Betsy, for sharing that story. And I think that you have shown positive coping strategies in very specific ways that families can adapt to the disease. And you've mentioned several that are very important, and we've tested them in all different kinds of randomized trials and show that they really make a difference in the quality of life of the person with dementia as well as the family caregiver's quality of life. And you mentioned, for example, changes to your physical environment and also to the way that you communicate with each other. And these are just very basic strategies that families can use. And in that respect, I agree with you that the glass is half full. These are strategies that are tested, they're proven, and they really can help families positively experience the disease as it progresses over time.
Laura, I'm reading that there is a trend toward more men becoming caregivers for spouses with Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. How big a trend is that?
Yes, well, that's a true growing trend, at least in the United States. I mean, women are still the primarily the family caregiver in most cases, but I believe the Alzheimer's Association in the United States have shown a trend towards upwards of 40% of men. And men do experience caregiving differently than women. We know that there are gender differences and so forth. And we're still trying to figure out the best ways to support men. But both men and women as caregivers need a lot of information, support, and of concrete strategies, as Betsy illustrated in telling her experiences.
Does this mean that Alzheimer's is affecting women more commonly than men, the fact that we're seeing more men now as in the caregiving role?
Well, I think that's true, and maybe Jason can kind of
Alzheimer's disease is a disease that doubly affects women because they live longer. Any insurance company can tell you that.
Right.
Okay, women live longer than men. Because they live longer, to pick up on Laura's point earlier, they're more likely to develop the disease. Mm-hmm. Age is a principal risk factor. It's a disease of aging. They're also more likely to be caregivers. If you come to the Penn Memory Center without a spouse, 9 times out of 10, the person that's brought you in is a daughter or a daughter-in-law or something. It is. I'm smiling only because it's just uncanny that the times when I've had a non-spousal caregiver come in who's a male, I can almost count on one hand. And it's interesting that, you know, the story of women in the late 20th century was to liberate themselves from the expectation you are going to be a homemaker. In some sense, the story of the 21st century is how are we going to deal with the expectation that they become a caregiver? I'm not saying that that's wrong to be one, but I think we're entering into a new dialogue as women in America about what are the expectations with respect to aging and the role of women. In the 20th century, it was expectations of women and the role in the home with children. We're into a new dialogue now about women and aging.
I would just want to add that there's an increase in male caregiving, most of whom are spouses, but there's also a growing number of sons and son-in-laws who are sharing in the care, as well as people who are caring long distance. So this is also people living with dementia who are living alone have often families who are coordinating care from a distance. So the family caregiving dynamics are changing. Yeah.
We'll go back to the phones to Norristown and Ken. Welcome, Ken, to Radio Times.
Hi, I'm 76 years old, and I think I'm okay, but I'm wondering whether there's a baseline test available, something beyond, you know, the Sunday supplement 10 questions you can ask yourself, but a professional baseline test that could be used later to determine whether I have mental deterioration.
Well, thank you for your question, Ken. Is there, Jason?
Ken, simply put, no. Having said that, one of the most fascinating pieces of legislation within the Affordable Care Act was the Medicare annual wellness visit, which included as part of statutory language screening for the presence of, quote, any cognitive impairment. It was fascinating. Congress wrote a practice guideline. And it led the field of NIH, et cetera, to struggle to say, well, what would a good measure be? And when we reviewed the literature, there are about 100 different ways to measure cognition. Measuring the brain is extremely difficult. I envy my colleagues in cardiology and other – I'm an internist, actually, where it's, you know, a few blood tests, a couple simple measures, and you kind of get a good picture of where the person's at. You know, there are many different ways to measure the brain and determine where they're at. I think one of the consensus points about measuring brain function is a single measure in time of cognition is not as valuable as repeated measures to look at change over time.
Yeah, I would just want to add here that there we don't have any evidence to date, but there are new studies that are looking at subjective memory complaints and trying to differentiate which of those complaints, because we all have memory complaints as we age, which of those complaints may signal other kinds of cognitive deterioration. So we don't know that yet, but this is a new area of research that is being conducted by multiple teams across globally, actually, because, again, people do have subjective memory complaints, and which of those may predict other kinds of changes has become of interest. And there's some indication that certain kinds of complaints may, in fact, be a predictor in addition to the research on biomarkers.
And that's definitely a research area now. Mm-hmm. Please don't go to the doctor and what are the three questions you're going to ask me
that's
going to tell my future?
Yeah.
But we're in an interesting dialogue with the future with Alzheimer's disease. We want to predict it.
And I this question, I want to try to move through this as quickly as we can because we only have a few minutes. But you just mentioned Obamacare and certainly the Affordable Care Act. There are some provisions getting ready to kick in the next few days. What do you expect the effect will be of Obamacare as it relates to Alzheimer's research and treatment, Jason?
With respect to research and treatment, I think that's a separate sort of item of line item in the budgets. But let me pivot on that. The majority of patients who have Alzheimer's disease already have health insurance. It's called Medicare. And that's a good thing. And thank God for Medicare. I think one of the advantages of the Affordable Care Act for patients with Alzheimer's disease, though, is that their caregivers who are younger, oftentimes children, adult children, now have a shot at getting health insurance. And, you know, as Laura can tell us, these people have real morbidities and needs because they're caregivers, oftentimes psychiatric. And I'm pleased that the Affordable Care Act is out there to expand the ability of people to get access to health care, such as the caregivers of my patients. Yeah.
Speaking of that, Laura, go ahead.
I just wanted to say we should also throw in there that there is – the United States now does have a National Alzheimer's Project Act referred to NAPA, which is Public Law 111-375, and President Obama passed it in January of 2011. And under the NAPA Act, Sebelius and her group have developed a web page called alzheimers.gov. And so under that act, we're charged, the country is charged with developing a plan for both research into the cure as well as care. So I think that that may be in combination with some of the changes that we'll see in accountable care organizations and so forth may produce what we're all hoping for is evidence-based comprehensive dementia care.
Yeah, I agree with Laura on all those points.
What would you say, Laura, to caregivers who find themselves in this situation right now? What do they need to know for themselves?
Well, I think that the Alzheimer's Association provides a really a one-stop shopping, all-purpose information and to arm themselves with as much knowledge as possible. There are, as I said, proven programs that have shown benefits to both families, and our problem is how to get them out there and integrated into clinical practice. But I think certainly there's some excellent online resources if families are using the internet.
I want to thank both of our guests. Laura Gitlin is professor in the Department of Community Public Health in the School of Nursing at Johns Hopkins University. Jason Karlowicz, professor of Medicine, Medical Ethics, and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. Thank you both for being with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Tracy.
Thank you, Tracy.
Certainly, 5 million people affected in the United States. Our population is aging. This is an issue that is only going to get bigger over time. Thank you so much for listening to Radio Times on WHYY. Bob Alt has been our engineer, and our producers are Emily Bryant, Debbie Bilder, Susan Greenbaum, and Patty McMahon. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscone.